have to put my body in the best position to oppose the resistance. So if you guys have ever heard me talk about this, exercises are only a means of imparting resistance or force against your body, right? So people look at exercise and they go, oh, this exercise is better than this one, this one's better than that one. Hold on. What I suggest you do is you start viewing a dumbbell, a barbell, a cable, a machine, a kettlebell, whatever, a rubber band, as simply an external means of imparting force against your body. It's just forces. So now, like, if I came up from beside you and pushed you, that's also just a force. And forces can be measured in two ways, amplitude and duration. That's it. So how much amplitude does this force have and how much duration does this force have, right? And so we look at, okay, what's the amplitude and duration of the force? And what muscle is most effectively set up to oppose the resistance? So if I have a resistance that's coming down on me vertically, I can change the way my body is oriented relative to that resistance to determine what muscles are most effective in actually moving that resistance. So you can change the orientation of the force by picking a different type of force, or you can change your orientation to it. Does that make sense? So what I encourage you guys to do is to stop mindlessly doing shitty exercises poorly and start thinking about, how can I make the muscle I'm trying to build more effective at opposing this resistance? So what does that require by necessity? It requires presence. I need to be here and like paying attention to what I'm doing. It needs to require intentionality. Like I want this pec to do what the greatest amount of work. And I would argue to say that it requires some degree of internal awareness, internal presence, what we call interoception, because I have to feel what is happening. Because here's a little hack for you. When you get to the bottom of a bench press, a dumbbell press, a cable fly, any of the exercises, and if you can't feel an appropriate stretch, then don't do another rep until you find the stretch. The stretch is the internal proprioceptive feedback that's telling your brain, okay, the muscle that I want to be loaded is loaded. Now, I need to make sure the tension stays on this muscle through every single centimeter or every single inch of the entire rep. And if it's not maximally effective. Now, that it's not always possible because not every exercise is built or set up to have maximal resistance at all parts of the resistance profile. But your goal should be, I need this muscle to work. I need to take advantage of this exercise as best I can. Therefore, I need this exercise to work, or this muscle to work, excuse me, at all segments of this range. So I'll give you an example. If I'm doing a dumbbell press, so I'll give you like the overhead example because it's easiest. Say I'm doing a chest press, but I'm going to give you overhead example because it's easy to see. If I'm in this position and holding a dumbbell there, there's no resistance on my shoulder or my pec, because if I'm here, same thing, right? There's no resistance. So I know at that point, well, I could stay there all day. There's no resistance on my pec. It shifts away from my pec. So maybe by intention, I avoid that position. And because I'm like, well, that's not really doing anything on my pec in that position. So I want to move toward challenge. I want to move toward muscular challenge. And how do I know my muscles are being challenged? Well, I should feel it in the right place. So you'll get these current scientists, and I put that in quotations and I'll tell you why. You get these current scientists saying that, you know, internal focus doesn't matter. And here's the problem I have with these scientists. And I don't know all of them, but most of them I do. Many of them don't work out. And many of them are master students who are 21 years old. And I love them. They're wonderful people. But they have no idea what the hell they're talking about. They know the science really well. They read the textbooks, they read the research, and they know it really well. But they don't actually go and like, okay, well, where does this science actually hold up to be true? And where does it break down? And so my encouragement to you guys is, for the rest of time, there's an enormous amount of value in taking internal feedback in and taking that as information to tell you what muscle is working. Because I can tell you definitively that, I got to sneeze, sorry, that just doing a push-up or just doing a bench press doesn't necessarily always work your pec. So you get all these guys saying, oh, dude, you got to do 3 sets of 6, you got to do 3 sets of 8. Bullshit. You have to make sure the right muscle is doing the work first before you can definitively say, okay, that those 3 sets of 8 are maximally stimulating reps. That's the standard, right? That's the standard. If you guys are taking notes, you want to think about something, you want to zero in on something, the goal is maximum stimulating reps. Now, the prerequisite to maximum stimulating reps is the muscle I'm actually training doing the work for the entire duration of the exercise? And it sh you shouldn't assume that it is, because I'll tell you, with 95% of the people I see in the gym, it's not. The body is shifting away from directing tension to one place, and it's distributing tension to multiple different places, which is not necessarily bad. But if your goal is building muscle, the goal is to isolate and distribute muscle, distribute tone or and tension to a smaller number of muscles, right? Or a specific muscle. You guys follow me? So the maximum stimulating rep model is absolutely true and effective. But what everyone misses is this prerequisite of, if all your reps suck, there's no such thing as any stimulating reps. So you got to make sure that you're actually directing tone. And when I'm at my camps and teaching camps, we talk about you're the conductor of the symphony. Your muscles are all just a symphony. Your brain is saying, hey, man, you tell me what to turn on. Put me into a position, put some resistance against me, and I'll turn on the right muscle. But you got to conduct it that way. You got to put the right muscle in the right position to oppose the resistance. So I'm going to simplify chest training for you. So chest training is the easiest thing in the world. If you have the right posture, if you have the right mobility, all muscles are incredibly easy to train. What is it? It's every muscle in the body has two ends. One end is closer to the midline of the body. One end is further away, right? The end closest to the midline of the body is called the origin. The end that's further away is called the insertion. All muscles do is shorten. So when this muscle contracts, it just goes, it pulls from this end, which is my insertion end right there on my humerus, and pulls across the body to the midline. That's all. Now, my job as someone who wants to build this muscle is to make that as challenging as I possibly can through the entire range. That's it. Now, there's nuance there, because obviously I could come up here and train upper pec clavicular fibers. I can come down here and train more of my kind of lateral pec fibers, lower pec fibers. So the path matters. But at the end of the day, it's really just like, how can I bring this insertion to this origin? So simple visual for you guys to get your head around, if you're tactile or kind of visual learners, is it's an elastic band. When I stretch it, it stretches. When I shorten it, it pulls together. So the ends pull apart and they pull together and they pull apart and they pull together. Notice at no time in that monologue did I say, I move this weight from here to there. That's not the goal. The goal is not to complete repetitions. The goal is to challenge muscles. And you got to get your head around that to be effective at this. And so if I want to maximally challenge a muscle, the prerequisite is I need to make sure that muscle is actually doing the work, not something else. I don't want to distribute the load. I want to focus the load. I want to focus the work. And I want to fatigue that muscle as much as I possibly can in the shortest amount of time. So I'm going to summarize this with a few big takeaways. Posture matters massively. You have to be able to get in the position. Many people have poor thoracic mobility here, right, in our back. We tend to be slouched because we sit too much. So here's an action item for you. If you find you have poor posture, your shoulders slouch forward a little bit, sit on the ground more often. Sit on the ground every day. Spend 15 to 30 minutes sitting on the ground. If you're watching television, if you're meditating in the morning, if you're on a call, like I sit on the ground a lot, and I still have my posture still not perfect because of 20 years of training like a meatbag, just heavy. The goal is like, I want to have a vertical spine when I'm sitting down on the ground. That should be a target, right? If I have a vertical spine, that means I have the paraspinal muscles, which are these muscles that run from the base of my skull all the way down to my sacrum. They're strong enough to hold me up, right? Many of you guys will sit on the ground and go like this. You don't have the postural strength and postural stability to hold you up. Now, so that's prerequisite number one. Prerequisite number two, that you're not going to be able to build your pecs, that you must have. If you can't get your hand above your head into, like, call it 120 degrees of shoulder, no, call it more 180 degrees of shoulder flexion, here, your pec development will be limited. Why? Because that requires your scapula to sit down your back, down your rib cage. And almost 100% of people I see who can't get into that position will always have limited upper pec development. That's a responsibility of the lower traps to kind of pull those scapula down. And we need that scapula to go down. If you have weak lower traps, you will almost always have weak upper pecs. Okay. Additional things, stability. And so postural stability matters at every different exercise. So if I'm sitting, if I'm standing, I'm sitting, I'm laying on my back, I must create the greatest amount of stability I can. And under no circumstance, and I'll asterisk this, under no circumstance, in my opinion, is a hyper arch more effective than an aligned posture. Here's the asterisk. If your only goal is moving as much weight as you possibly can, your goal of hyper arching is to decrease the range. If your goal is building as much, excuse me, if your goal is moving as much weight as you can, decrease the range, arch that back. But if your goal is building as much muscle as you can, a hyper arch will take away from stability and likely decrease your likelihood of building the pecs. So my, and this is nuanced because everyone's structure is so different. If you look around, everyone's got different size rib cage, different orientation, different length arms, different length muscle belly, so many different factors. But in general, too much arch will definitively take away from your ability to build your pecs. So instead of arching up so much, try using slightly varied bench angles. It's a better, so when adjusting the body's orientation to this vertical resistance, which is bars and dumbbells, you have two options, right? You can adjust the body by arching, or you can adjust the bench. So my suggestion is you minimally adjust the body and adjust the bench more, if that makes sense. So I want to go from a slight decline to a flat to a slight incline to a more inclined to high incline to a vertical. And I want to be capable at every one of those ranges because every one of them has a different ability to stimulate the muscle. I'm talking a lot. I'm gonna pause, take a breath, and ask some questions. Stevie, anything to add to that?
I think you nailed it. One of the things that I've been trying to sum up so people can have just like a clear action item, especially people who find that there's like a lot of cues and a lot of things to focus on, is just like on the note that you said about making sure that you're actually cognizant of what muscle is being loaded, is using the thought of like acceleration and deceleration throughout the motion so you can be like aware of that happening. So if you're using like acceleration through the eccentric as a thought, that would give you some kind of understanding that you're probably losing tension. So just making sure you're owning the tempo, because you see it all the time in things like squats too, right? Or bench press, like they'll come down and then it's just thump and it just drops and the person can't get into it. And you'll usually see the problems like us coaches, we'll see like anterior dumps to the shoulder, or you'll see like scapula moving. But for people on the call, I think that would be a great thing to take home is like just consider acceleration, deceleration as a good tell to whether or not you can actually control the motion and therefore be able to control the muscle doing the motion.
Yeah, I love that. So I'll add something to that. I actually sometimes will cue, use, and this is really nuanced, use the pec to accelerate the movement. Use the pec to decelerate the movement. But that's not the same as accelerate the weight and decelerate the weight. That's not to say that acceleration and deceleration are wrong, but when you're learning and you're relatively low on the skill profile, then going fast will almost always take tension away from the pec, right? So we don't necessarily want to train fast. We want to make sure if we are training fast that there's a difference here, and this is super nuanced, but it's contract hard, and the hard contraction creates acceleration, not just I want to move this thing as fast as I can. Now, I want to just acknowledge something. You'll see a lot of other coaches out there be like, just move the weight fast, and they're not wrong. So here's how we nuance this. If you're trying to move the weight fast, you are recruiting more muscle fibers. That's a good thing, but you're not necessarily recruiting the ones you want, right? So just because I'm moving weight fast, I could be using more front delt, more tricep, more momentum. And so once you get good at it, the cue becomes accelerate with the pec. But for most people, going fast is just a recipe for not doing anything to the pecs, it or any muscle for that matter. So one example that I use when I'm teaching is like, if I passed you a 20-pound weight and I said, hold this. The only time that weight weighs 20 pounds is when it's not moving. As soon as it starts moving, it's changing its inertial properties. So if it's going up, it's becoming less. So if I throw a weight up in the air, it floats, it stops midair, and then it starts coming down, picking up acceleration. And it comes down, it's going to be faster and weigh more than 20 pounds at the bottom. So it's important to know, like, the more you're accelerating, you actually change the inertial properties of that resistance. And so if you want to challenge the muscle through the full range, which is our goal, you want to make sure the muscle is actually doing work through the full range. Does that make sense? Clear as mud? Rich is like, I got you, man. I got you. thought it was Andrew
And Ben,
O'Connor.
I'll play devil's advocate for a quick second because just based on what you were just talking about, you kind of see it a lot with pulling motions, but the same with pressing. They think further distance is always better. And sometimes they come down too far, and then the shoulder turns into this internal rotation, and then they lose tension across the pec. I see that a lot.
Yeah. So the thanks, Andrew. I was looking for you. I was like, I want Andrew's feedback. So guys, the motion of the pec, remember, is this elastic band. So if I find my insertion, I encourage you guys all to do this now. Follow the pec line, which is out on the rib cage, outside the rib cage. Like, find that pec, and it comes up here on your shoulder, and it inserts here on your arm. And you'll feel it, like the muscle, there's a big muscle belly, and then it kind of turns into a tendon. Like, you can feel where it turns, where it connects to the bone. And so all we need to do is we need to take this point as far as we can away from this one. But that doesn't mean I'm going to rotate my spine and do all these obscure movements. I'm going to keep my spine really stable, pull my shoulder back as far as it'll comfortably go, and then use the pec to pull me out of that, right? Even if I'm benching, I'm using the pec to pull me out of it. I'm not just trying to throw the weight. So the easiest way to learn, if you guys just all do this, if I go back and my palm is facing the sky, and I lengthen my pec as much as I can. So I'm contracting my back, and that tells me that, okay, my shoulder, if I'm contracting my trap in the back and my rhomboid and pulling my shoulder back, that's a pretty good idea of a relatively lengthened pec. And now from this point, all I want you to do is find that pec insertion and pull it across your body. So the pec is kind of pulling you out of that position and pull it across the body to the front of the body. So that's what the pec does. Now, it doesn't change if it's a press. Right, that obviously looks like a fly, but it doesn't change what the pec is doing if it's a press. The only thing that's different is my elbow changes. The pec still pulls across the body. And so it's kind of wrapping around the rib cage and pulls across the body. And so what you can visually see is, or visually try to see, is an elastic band that wraps around your rib cage. And when I let that elastic band go, it pulls back to the midline. It's not about how far I can move the weight away from my body toward the ceiling, nor is it about how far I can move that weight behind me toward the floor. It's how far did my pec stretch and how much did my pec contract? That's it. And it's very visually apparent. When you guys come to camp, we'll show you all this stuff. It's so easy to see when you're standing right there watching over someone would do it. You're like, oh, yep, definitely been doing that wrong. And here's the thing. When I say wrong, you're probably doing it with some arbitrary amount of effectiveness, right? But it's not maximal effectiveness. And every single person I've met, including myself at times, has an opportunity to get better. There's always an opportunity. And here's why it's even me, because your body is designed to cheat. And for even an instant, if you go mindless, you're just like mindlessly doing shit, your body will just cheat because your body knows that's what your body does. Eventually, you'll get so good at it that your body will be like, I'm good at this 98% of the time, 99% of the time. It's what we call unconscious competence. I don't think about it, I just master it. And that's kind of the desired end state. Eric, fire away. What's the question, buddy?
Sorry, I'm at work. I hopped on late. I didn't want to hijack it, but I had a question about one-armed dumbbell rows on the back. For me, for some reason, it doesn't matter. Like if I'm doing them angled on a bench or like back parallel to the floor, like I feel them like up in the top of my neck, unless I do a cable. So I just heard you talking about stability, and that just kind of popped in. I was just curious of your thoughts. I've tried to do. Steve sent me a bunch of videos with different cues, but I just don't. It's just. I don't know what it is. It's just a weird, not comfortable sensation. So.
I get it, man. And I could try to talk you through it all day, but the easiest thing is going to be like, let's put you through it somehow. So the way that I might suggest cueing it is, what if no part of your body at any point in that exercise was able to go up toward the ceiling? It was only able to go back toward your hip. So if I'm in this position, like most people when they do a row, I can show you guys this. Most people when they do a row, they do this, right? They pull back toward the ceiling, they pull up. But at no point can you go up. So it's just more like driving down toward my hip. And what you'll notice at that point is it's on my, so you're basically trying to take your shoulder away from your ear, right? So I'm trying to drive my elbow and my shoulder down away from my ear. And then I row kind of to my hip. And that's kind of the best example I can give you, man. And it sounds like one of two things is happening. You could have a tendency to kind of let that shoulder roll forward a little bit, which is super common. So when people pull, they want the shoulder kind of goes up, and you don't end up shortening the lat, you end up shortening the rear delt. But if you can roll your shoulder back and down, like down as in away from my ear, then that almost shouldn't happen. So I'm sure Steve's worked with you a lot on this, man, but the cue is like get your shoulder away from your ear and don't let, yeah, that's if you just cue that, then you'll be much better off. Oh, I don't know if that really answers your question, man. Sorry, it's the best I got.
No, great. Thank you.
Bill, what's up, buddy?
Hey, so can you hear me okay?
I got you.
Yeah, awesome. So, when you talk about muscle building and particularly for the pecs, I noticed that like a lot of the exercises that we have a certain tempo, right? And so like time under tension is a big thing in the industry right now. Like, can you talk to that and explain a little bit, like when we're talking about muscle fatigue, is it better to do slow, super controlled reps, or is there a time when you should be shooting for trying to hit that, the 12 to 15 rep? I know it's not a specific number, but just can you kind of talk to that and help me understand how that fits into the theme here?
Sure, Bill. So I hate to confuse the matter, but I'm probably going to do it. And in general, the only tempo that I'm really concerned with is control. And so at times, there's value in doing really slow eccentrics and really slow concentrics. But if we're talking just pure muscle building, I don't give a shit if you're going slow. Or like, as all I care about is, are you super controlled and actually using the muscle that you want to? Because I'm more concerned with, if we talk about the goal of muscle building, the singular goal is tension, maximum tension, right? So I get maximum tension over variable time. That's kind of the equation of muscle building. So my goal is to maximize tension. So if you're doing super slow reps and it slows down or decreases your ability to produce tension, it may not be useful. And so it may be inducing fatigue more than it's inducing muscular tension. And so, guys, this is an important thing to acknowledge. Fatigue is actually an interference mechanism. It's not necessarily an objective. So I know most people want to feel tired when they're done, but fatigue has been shown to be more of an interference mechanism. So it interferes with your ability to produce tension. So if you go into the gym with the desire to be tired or to make your pecs feel tired, you're missing the point. The first objective is I have to create as much tension, end-to-end pulling of these muscles as I possibly can first. Once I've maximized tension and I've noticed my ability to produce tension starts going down, then and only then can I switch to trying to induce fatigue. Because fatigue is a late in the exercise, excuse me, a late in the workout type goal. The reason we want to save fatigue for late in the workout is because we want to build the resistance to fatigue through mitochondrial efficiency. We want to improve your mitochondrial effectiveness, your body's ability to run energy through the system. So in general, I don't give a shit about tempo until we're trying to induce fatigue. And when we're trying to induce fatigue, then tempo is going to be probably your best mechanism, right? Or you're one of your best friends. So in the beginning, Bill, if you're doing whatever the tempo is, I think myself and the coaches mostly prescribe different tempos because we watch what you do. As an example, I have some clients who I'll give them 5 second eccentrics. Why do I give them 5 second eccentrics? Because if I give them 5 second eccentrics, it turns into a 3 second eccentric, right? Do I actually want them to do a 5 second eccentric? Not usually, maybe because it's controlled for them, right? But if they did 2 or 3 seconds with exemplary control, then I'm happy. That's more the acid test for me is tempo when it comes to tempo. Now, the second half of that is inducing fatigue on purpose at the end of your workout to become more resistant to fatigue, then introducing extended tempos, extended time is a really useful tool. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Josh, what you cooking up, man? I see you working over there.
Hi, Ben.
Yep.
During dumbbell lateral raise, I cannot isolate my deltoid muscle. It always included the back muscles.
Yeah, that man. So it's super common. So the question or the comment was, I can't isolate my delts. I can only isolate, but it also incorporates my traps. It's super common. So as we age, even some people who are very young don't have the ability to differentiate between movement at the shoulder joint, the glenohumeral joint, and the scapula. They just kind of move globally. They move together. And that's super common. And you just have to learn to differentiate the two. So I want to be able to move just my glenohumeral joint, which is the shoulder joint, just my trap or move my scapula on my rib cage and do them both together. It's a skill thing. You need to just practice. That's the only answer I have, unfortunately. Yeah, sorry, man. You know how I learned? I'll tell you guys how I learned. The first 5 years of my bodybuilding career when I was 15 to probably 15 to 19, I only used 15-pound dumbbells. I used 15-pound dumbbells and probably did thousands and thousands and thousands of reps. And I learned very specifically how to nuance between I'm only moving and contracting my delt, or I'm moving and contracting my delt and my trap. I learned to differentiate because I did thousands and thousands of reps every week to learn how to move those muscles well. And then once I knew the movement pattern, I was using 85-pound dumbbells for strict form when I was competing, you know, because my body didn't know how to cheat. My body knew how to differentiate the form. Now here's an important thing. If any of you guys have ever studied weightlifting, Steve will jump into this one, the Romanian weightlifting program, they won't touch a weight. They won't touch a weight for the first 5 years, 5 to 6 years of their training. They only use a broomstick. They're just greasing that. They're rewiring that movement pattern. And then once they give the kids a bar, like boom, they know exactly what to do. Have you ever seen that stuff, Stevie?
Yeah, there's a lady. She does a lot of judging now because she's been in the sports for a long time. She's actually pretty incredible to watch because it's like she's incredible. Her name is Michaela Breeze, and she's on Instagram. Check her out. But she has like a world record, right? And she had these bad patterns. And her story was that she went and got like a traditional coach. You know, like us coaches, they're a little different than like a Romanian coach. Romanian coach just stands there and hits you with a ruler, right? And that's what he did. He actually said, like, no weights for you. Here's a stick. In 5 years, she had to basically be like, I have to do this for 5 years. And then she did it. And now she's a world record holder.
Yeah, my daughter's a gymnast. And she's a high-level gymnast now. But when she started, they put her on a beam. You know, like, for us to do, she's doing, like, backflips on the beam and, like, cartwheels and shit on the beam. And she's incredible. But when she started, they put the beam on the floor. I'm like, hey, this is all you get. So if you fall off, you're going 1 inch or 2 inches, you know, like just so he takes away the fear thing and just gets her to practice reps and reps and reps and reps. And eventually you can move it up 10 feet and she's not going to fall off. Andy, I haven't seen you on here in a while, man. How you doing? I don't know if I've seen you on here before at all. Andy Melmed. How are you, Andy?
I'm good. Thanks. I'm very, very good. I've been following you. I try to come in whenever I can. I've been following you for over 10 years. I started with your MI foundation and went to the Hypertrophy Max and went to your, from there I went to, I think you did the Extreme, Cell Extreme stuff you did. And so I've been following you a while. I'm in my early 50s. So I've been lifting since I was in my teenage years. So, yeah, ever since I followed you about 10 years ago, I just keep reading everything you have. I listen to all your blog, your podcasts and all that stuff. So I joined a couple of weeks ago. Actually, no, I joined back in, it was like December now. And I'm working with Dan. He's great. Yep. And we spend, have really good calls where he tells me, I ask him a lot of questions. He teaches me a lot about the body anatomy, insertions, like you were doing today, origins and I just keep trying to picture all this stuff in my mind, but I've always kind of followed your protocol of, you know, set up, stabilize, initialize. I'm doing all that stuff for quite some time now. So it's become second nature. I think I went through MI40 about 3 or 4 times just to make sure I became like, you know, I didn't have to think about it anymore. You know, came kind of numb to it. And, but I always walk in the gym. People probably wonder, why is the guy talking to himself? Like, okay, you're going to set up, you're going to stabilize, you're going to, I would Google over and over again. And, till I just got it, became like clockwork for me. And, it's had really positive effects. I'm doing really well, and I'm just trying to gain a few more pounds in terms of muscle strength. And I should say not really strength, size at this point. Mostly chest, shoulders, back. One place I've always had is fairly good chest in the lower and the sides, but I've always had trouble in the top center, trying to get that full roundedness up top center where you get that split look. Yep. So he's working with me on that. Trying a lot of different things, a lot of adduction exercise and all that stuff. So all these things about origin insertion certainly help. They're certainly beneficial. But in general, I've just been doing it a long time. So I appreciate, you know, everything that Dan's been showing me and that, you know, like I said, I've been listening to you a long time And if I had a question at all, I was just actually putting something in the chat. It was that recently I watched a video on a popular fitness channel where they were talking about the topic of the discussion was basically revolved around set numbers, rep numbers, you know, a pyramiding up in weight, down in weight, that kind of stuff, time under tension. And it was whole thing was based on like people typically do 8 to 12 reps for hypertrophy. And that's like kind of become the what people ascertain as the norm, right? But everybody's different. But I was wondering your take on or your perspective on that, because the individual is fairly popular, but that's okay. I don't just listen to one person. I try to, you know, I'm very receptive and open when it comes to listening to as many people as possible. Trying to also at the same time, you know, you got to take things with a grain of salt because some people just say anything and then other people say something completely different. And you don't know which one to listen to. So I stick to just one or two, like yourself in particular. But what's your take on like set number hypertrophy? Again, focus. So what's your take on set numbers, rep numbers, pyramiding up, pyramiding down, a combination? Because there's no one size fits all. And every time you go to the gym to work a muscle, maybe it's better to diversify and not be stuck on three sets of 8, 10, 12, 12, 10, 8, go high, then go low, low, high, that kind of stuff. So I'll just leave it at that because I've already talked a lot.
Thanks, man. So yeah, I love the question. And you're right, there's a lot of nuance there. But I'd say the first objective to think about is this concept of maximum stimulating reps. And so as an extreme example, if we did a set of 20, how many of those reps are actually going to induce some type of stimulus, right? So meaning you know, when you do a set of 20, it's probably not to the last like 3 or 4 reps that you're finally now starting to like, oh gosh, this is starting to grind, meaning the force velocity curve changes a little bit. Like first couple, you're kind of going fast. Then you start getting to the point where you're like, oh shoot, I'm slowing down. And those muscles, when you start to really grind through it, those are the ones that are stimulating to hypertrophy, right? So the goal in hypertrophy is to have the greatest efficiency, so the least number of wasted reps and the maximum number of tension generated. So in my opinion, and science will back this, your ideal rep range for hypertrophy is somewhere between 5 and 8 repetitions. Now, that's not to say that doing sets of 20 isn't valuable. I still think sets of 20 is incredibly valuable. I would just save the sets of 20 for more of the inducing fatigue or to attempt to induce the resistance to fatigue. So early in the workout, we're going to do things that are sets of 5, sets of 6, maybe sets of 8, depending how well you execute them. Because if you're not very good at something, I'm probably not going to give you a bunch of 5s. I might give you a bunch of 8s. Because most people, if you give them a weight that they can do 5 times, it's pretty damn heavy. And they're going to be grinding through every single one. If your form is kind of off and not very good, you're going to hurt yourself. So for someone who's new, somewhat new, I'll probably regress the load a little bit and give you sets of 8 to 10 as your primary hypertrophy mechanism. Someone who's a little more advanced, I'd drop the weights down and I'd go somewhere in the range of 4 to 6 for your primary stimulating reps. Now, there's some mechanisms or some methods that we can use that can allow us to stay in that maximum stimulating rep range longer. And so one of the things we're throwing around a lot in our community now is this idea of rest pause, basically, right? So if you were to pick a weight you can do for 8 and stop at 6 or stop at 5, rest for 15 to 20 seconds, do another 2, rest for 15 to 20 seconds, do another 2, rest for 15 to 20 seconds, do another 2. Now you just did, with a weight you can do for 8, you just did 12. And you're like, oh, so I did more work at that maximum stimulating load in less time, right? So it may be equally effective as far as growth, but more effective from a time perspective. So I guess in summary, to answer your question, the objective should be to get yourself down to the place where you can do an exercise for 5 to 6 reps and do it really, really meticulously well, like masterfully. But most people aren't there. Most people aren't there. So I
All
would
right.
prescribe 8 to 10 people who are on their way to 5 to 6.
Okay. If I said 20 reps, I made a mistake. I meant 8 to 12. I don't know if
No,
I
no,
meant
no. I'm using 12 as an example. Or
Oh,
excuse me, I'm
okay.
using 20 as an
All right. And
example.
how about sets? Because some people say you should do 3, you know, 10, 12, 8, or you should do 4 sets. You should do, some people do the Mike Mentzer. You just do 1 set. So I mean, again, I know you could try different things at different times. You don't have to be married to any one particular, you know, protocol every time you go in the gym. But Have you found your experience at certain things? I mean, again, it might be certain things work better for different people, but for you and for what all the people you've worked with, do you find that the certain number of sets, going up in weight, going down in weight, changing it up, doing a one set max, all out, all you can do, staying under about 48 to 50 seconds per set to hit that hypertrophy time under tension number that they always say greater than 45 seconds around is where you want to be, 45 to 50. Is that all stuff viable, or is that stuff that's just been thrown around through the years and that's not the latest and most scientifically backed, information data?
All of it has validity in different contexts. So I'll answer your question about the number of sets. In my experience, the number of sets varies person to person. And here's how I tend to think about it. This is a generic way to think about it, but here's how I tend to think about it. Someone who has a greater ability to recover, I'll give them more volume. I think if you can recover from more volume, I'm going to give you more volume. And if you have a low ability to recover, I'm going to give you lower volume, right? Mm-hmm. So how many sets over the week? I don't know, man. Like, how well do you recover? Sorry, I got to sneeze. what's your HRV, heart rate variability? How many days does it take you to recover after a hard workout? On a scale of 1 to 10, how sore are you, right? So it's a variable thing. So some of my clients may get 6 to 8 sets per body part per week. Some of my clients may get 25 to 30 sets per week, right? Okay. So it's variable. It's variable based on, like, how well do you eat? How well do you sleep? How much stress? Here's a really, 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 really important concept. Is exercise the most stressful thing in your life? For some people, the answer is, I put so much time and effort into my exercise, that's by far my biggest stressor, mm-hmm. which case I can put more into. If it's not your biggest stressor, meaning you got some financial stuff or some life stuff or mm-hmm. some whatever, or business stuff, then, man, you can't recover from that much volume. So you certainly can't handle it. So all these people who are putting these numbers on volume, I think it's again, coming back to this, just like, they're looking at it through a straw. They're like, oh, this is the best place to be. I'm like, nah, man, you just can't. So the goal is, I think the goal is maximum recoverable volume. Like, I want to give you as much volume as you can recover from, I think.
Okay.
And if you're not recovering, that's too much.
Yeah. All right. So I guess the answer is really just everybody's different. Try all these different things, different times, different number of sets, different number of reps, and find out where you seem to get the most response in terms of a positive feedback on your system, able to recover. But wherever you see the most benefit and wherever you see it's actually working, stick to that, as opposed to just trying to grind yourself into you're not trying to force a round peg into a square hole like a lot of people seem to be doing. You're just trying to figure out what works best for you as an individual and your body and your recovery ability and that kind of stuff, which means I got to keep trying different things. I've been doing it for a long time, but keep going until I find what seems to be the most beneficial for me.
So if I was to give you a general rule, here's what I would say. Do 6 to 8 sets per muscle group and aim to make those more effective.
Okay.
Every 4 days. About.
Okay.
So if you're training pecs, you do the Monday and Thursday or Monday and Friday.
Yep.
And your goal is, I'm only getting 6 to 8 sets. And my goal is, I need to be as effective as I can at these. And so I should say this, those are your maximum stimulating sets, right? You're mm-hmm. getting 6 to 8 sets of, like, heavy, high amounts of tension. If you added in some additional sets on top of that, which were intentionally inducing fatigue, meaning, like, I want to become more resistant to fatigue, I wouldn't even count those in the total number of sets. We're going to add in an extra four sets with the intention of actually inducing muscular fatigue. So just separating in your mind sets that maximize tension and sets that maximize fatigue. Because I think those can almost be viewed as, they're obviously not separate, but at some level you can view them as separate because you're kind of trying to induce two adaptations.
Okay. All right, here we go. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Eddie. Appreciate you, man. Yeah. Cody.
Yeah, Ben. Earlier you spoke to foot mobility and acupuncture ball and mats, things like that. I know I have a struggling with even the way I walk. I know I'm not transferring weight properly, things like that. So I'm definitely going to start looking into this acupressure ball and mat situation. Is there any little movements that I should be implementing in my morning routine, per se, just get my day started that would aid with ankle mobility and foot mobility?
You know, the single best thing, man, that I do often for ankle mobility, foot strength, is yoga. And not specifically any type of yoga, but standing on one foot and spending a lot of time trying to like manipulate my body around that one foot. So what you'll find when you stand on one foot is that foot starts to like orient itself, especially if you're moving the leg that's in the air and it's like moving this way, it's moving this way, it's moving that way. If you move that leg around, the foot that's on the ground is going to start trying to orient itself and start to catch the ground. It's going to like, you know, try to root into the ground. So that's probably my single best, you know, piece of intervention, I guess. Spreading your toes open. So there's some toe yoga exercises that I add into True Coach. So we can ask your coach to add those in there. Just ask them to build some. I have a whole foot program in there. So
okay,
we can add that in for you.
Yeah, I just started on today, so I don't know what to expect moving forward. So that's a good start. Thanks for that.
All these things are on the table, man. If you're like, hey, coach, I want to get my feet stronger, tell them they'll do it for you, man. Like all our coaches are very competent and capable in those areas. And if we don't know the answer, we'll amongst us, somebody knows the answer.
Perfect. Thanks.
Thank you, man. Questions, comments, concerns, gentlemen. Did you guys find any value in that, or is it? Did it feel like too much information? Is there something of value that you got out of that? Good.
Yeah. I was going to say honestly, Ben, I enjoy. I haven't been able to join a lot of these calls, but you really make things simple but technical, and I really like being able to boil this down and say, okay, there's so much information out there on everything from nutrition to how to build muscle and all that stuff. It's generally confusing. There's just information overload, but I really appreciate your ability to boil this down to some simple practices that have been proven effective. I've been in the program for 6 months and I could not be happier with where I am physically. And that's thanks to you guys and the coaches.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate you, man. Yeah, dude. We're always like, I always pass through the lens of how I want to provide value for, like, I know time is very valuable and it's hard to leave your family or leave your job or like so many things you could be doing. So we do really take it seriously. So thanks, guys. I appreciate it. All right, guys. On that note, nobody else got questions. I'll let you get back to your lives. I appreciate you all very much, and I'll see you here next week. Have a great one. Thanks, guys. Thanks, coaches.